The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Anne Marie Anderson, and I'm the marketing director at Temple University Press. It is a pleasure to introduce our guest tonight. A little bit of background. Temple University Press is the proud publisher of Whisper Not, Benny Golson's autobiography. We're also the book publishing arm of Temple University. And like most university presses in the U.S. and Canada, we primarily publish academic scholarship. But following in our founders, Temple's founder, Russell Conwell's footprint, we also published books about the acres of diamonds in our own backyard. And boy, do we have some diamonds here tonight. Benny Golson is an internationally famous jazz composer, arranger, saxophonist, and he's composed music for some of the greatest American jazz musicians. Of course, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, Ella Fitzgerald, Quincy Jones, and he's also played for some of my idols, Sarah Vaughan, if you know me. I wanted to be Sarah Vaughan when I was a little girl. But the thing about it, Benny Golson is Philly made, so he's my diamond. And with him tonight is Jeff Duperron, who's hailing from the best jazz station in the city, WRTI. Hey, hey. So I'd be remiss if I didn't introduce some people who are here tonight that made the Benny Golson book possible. Temple University Press Director Mary Rose Musi is here. Acquisitions Editor Sarah Cohen, I see her come in. Production Editor Dave Wilson. And Publicity Guru Gary Kramer. I also need to recognize and thank Andy Cohen, who does a fabulous job coordinating the literary program here at the library. Please join me in giving Benny Golson and Jeff Duperron a Philly welcome.
Benny Golson, give it up.
You know, I'm back home, but things have changed. It didn't look like this when I left. They waited for me to leave to do all of this stuff.
But you got taller, too, so everything that was big that you thought was huge is now smaller.
I never thought about that.
See, think about that one. We're glad that you can come in tonight. Oh, and by the way, there may be three, I say maybe, three lucky individuals here in the auditorium because Joe Fields, who's the executive producer of Benny's latest release, it's called Horizon Ahead, sent me three copies. And under the seat, somewhere in here, Andy put my business cards under three seats. So if you want to just, before we start, you want to stand up just to see if you are the lucky person, come and see me after this conversation, and I'll have a copy of the music that you've been listening to. I got them up and working, Benny, didn't you?
Yeah, like I'm telling you.
Just hold on to your card, and when Benny comes out front to autograph his autobiography, then I'll have the CDs with me. Okay? It is a great pleasure to sit here tonight. I'm going to put it in my hand. That's going to be easier for me. Come here tonight and have this conversation with you about this marvelous new book, Whisper Not, the autobiography of Benny Golson. And I'd like to start at the beginning. Describe for us the elation that you felt when your mother came home with this big case and you opened it up and didn't know what you were doing when you finally pulled it out of the case.
The feeling, what's the word? Ineffable. There are no words to describe it. I was transformed into somebody else. Yeah. A happy kid. We had just gotten off welfare. And I thought if I got a saxophone, it would be one of those silver ones you see hanging in the pawn shop window, you know, something like that. And she brought home a brand new Martin saxophone. A dollar down and a dollar for the rest of your life.
But once you got that saxophone out of its case, did you even know how to assemble it?
I didn't know how to assemble it because when I saw Arnett Cobb at the Earl Theater at 11th and Market, do you remember that?
That was before my time.
Uh-oh. Then maybe, well, I'm not hiding my age, yeah. But I was a kid, 11th and Market, the Earl Theater. First time I'd seen a live band, and I was a piano student. I thought I was going to be a concert pianist. And when I saw Lionel Hampton and Arnett Cobb get up out of the saxophone section and walk to the edge of the stage, and that microphone came up out of the stage, I was in awe. The band made a break, and he swooped in with that memorable solo on Flying Home. The piano started to fade.
You were hooked, in other words.
When I told my mother, you know, because we were saying, oh, yes, you know, Miss Conley, when she retires, she was a church organist, then maybe I'd be in a position to take over to become the organist. And I was saying, yeah, because I like the organ and everything. But now here I am telling her, Mom, I don't think I want to play the piano anymore. I want to play the saxophone. Whereupon she uttered, oh, my God, you're going to be a dope addict. Well, that was resolved, and she became my champion for me and my buddy John Coltrane because we were amateurs, and we were in my living room every day with those 78. Do you remember 78 records?
Tell me
you do.
I've got some of those.
Thank you.
Yes.
When we got those 78 records, they were black and shiny, and they cost 37 cents for each. But when we finished moving that tune arm back and forth, what did he do there? Wait a minute, what was that third part? Wait a minute, what chord did he play? They were dull and gray.
Nice thing about getting that saxophone in your hand and starting to play is that you started to develop skills that today are revered around the world. So thank you so much for thinking about changing the instrument and going to a saxophone, because we really appreciate it as listeners.
Yeah, well, when that was all getting started, it was the summertime, you know, and the windows were open. We had the screens in. And when I played, the neighbors could hear me, of course. And they wanted to kill me. It was horrible. And then John joined me, and they wanted to kill two people.
Your mom had some wonderful things to say to both you and John Coltrane when you came back from a gig that you thought you were going to be on, but as it turned out...
Oh, you remember that?
Yeah, you were fired, right?
That's the night we got fired and didn't know it. Yeah, we thought we were doing pretty good. And Jimmy Johnson and his ambassadors, you see. And we were playing the gig. The music wasn't exciting, but we'd come out of my living room and we're playing before people. Well, we were on our way. This is where we wanted to go. And we thought we were doing pretty good. But I guess we weren't, because Jimmy sent his son by my house a night. We usually gigged around, well, on the weekend, Friday and Saturday, sometimes Sunday. I mean, it was good for me because I was still in high school. I was 16, John was 18. But he sent his son by to tell me, I was at 17th and Diamond, that the gig was canceled. Then he went over where John lived, over 12th and Master, to tell him that the gig was canceled. So John came over to my house, because he was always there, because we had a house, and he was living in an apartment, so it was a little more room, the record player and the piano in the room, and what we were doing, it was more conducive to playing. And we should use play the records. So he came over, and we were lamenting about not being able to play, losing that gig. And so we were sitting there with sad faces, and my mother said, why the sad faces? And John said, oh, we had a gig, Miss Golson, and it was canceled. The music was corny, but we wanted to play, you know. Now, my mother She was not a college graduate. She didn't even finish high school. But in the old school, they said she had a lot of mother wit, you know. She could have easily gotten a job with the FBI, the KGB, Scotland Yard. She said...
In other words, she was on your case.
Yeah.
In your business.
Yeah. She said, what time did he send his son? I said, well, he came here about 6:30. She said, well, what time was the gig? I said, 8:30. She said, nobody cancels a job 2 hours before you're supposed to play. And then she thought again. She said, I'll bet you they're playing without you. And John chirped in, oh, no, Mrs. Golson, they wouldn't do that. She said, it was me. I'd go up there and see. I looked at John. He looked at me. He said, let's go. It was about 6 blocks from my house, 21st and Columbia Avenue, the American Legion Hall. So we got about a half a block from the American Legion Hall, and we heard this band playing. John said, Benny, they're playing our music. I said, John, they got about 6 different local bands here, Jimmy Gorm, Jimmy Adams, Jimmy Johnson, and there were some others. I said, we have to see who they are. So we went up to the door, you know, where you get the tickets, and you open the door, and you had to go down the steps and across the dance floor, and the band was situated against the wall. Well, we could hear them when the door opened, but we couldn't see them. So the next time the door opened, I guess they thought we were crazy, we fell on our stomachs, and we could see them. There was somebody in my chair, and there was somebody in his chair. We went back to my house, and when we opened the door and walked in, my mother said, what happened? John said, you're right, Miss Golson. When we went in the living room, we didn't even sit down this time. We just stood in the middle of the floor. And I remember it like it was yesterday. I was so hurt. Jeff, I really wanted to cry. And I know he wanted to cry. But we were too hip to cry in front of each other. You know, we just stood there in pain. And my mother came over. She saw we were hurting. Put her arms around both of us, and she gave us a nice big squeeze, and she said, baby, don't you all worry. One day you both will be so good they won't have enough money to pay you. But we didn't believe her. But years later, we were playing, not together, up at the Newport Festival. John had just gotten his soprano, and he had just recorded My Favorite Things. He was noodling around, and I was trying to find a reed. Art Farm and I were there. We had just formed the jazz tet, and we had recorded Killer Joe. And he took the horn out of his mouth and started laughing. I said, what? He said, you remember Miss Golson said? I said, what? And what I just said, one day they wouldn't have enough money to pay us. I said, yes. He said, well, those guys who fired us are still in Philadelphia, and we're at Newport. And we both started laughing.
And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah, it was something, yeah. And we got better. We got better. What happened? We got so good that the neighbors now started to put in requests when my mother would go to the market. Do they know how to play Don't Blame Me? Can they play Body and Soul or Embraceable You? So we'd play those tunes, and they'd put up with the other nonsense that we were doing.
Between you and John, when you did play, which one of you took the longest solos?
Oh, I don't remember that. I don't remember. Maybe we both took long solos. But we had an old upright. I was a piano student here before. We had an old upright piano in the living room. And there was an overstuffed chair by the window. He would put his leg over the arm and the horn in the cushion. And one of the songs he used to like to play was There's No You. And I would half play the piano. I was a classical student. I didn't know much about jazz on the piano. And when I wanted to play, he would come to the piano and play worse than I did. And then I would try to play something. But we only had each other. There were no schools where you could learn, no universities, just the 78 records. And that's what we were doing. And we did that a lot until we joined Jimmy Johnson. We thought we were on our way until we got fired.
You talked about playing music and creating music, which is what you've done profoundly over the years. Compositions like Stablemates, Long Came Betty, Killer Joe. And one in particular that has been what I'd like to refer to as an evergreen in the jazz repertoire, and it's one that you wrote paying homage to a great friend of yours, Clifford Brown. Describe to the audience, and if it's too painful, you know, please just say so, but describe how you felt when you first learned about Clifford Brown passing away and what was happening at that moment in time.
I happened to be, let's see, where am I? I'm in Philadelphia. I happened to be playing the Apollo Theater in New York with Dizzy Gillespie. And we were on a break, standing outside the stage door at the rear of the theater on 126th Street. Well, up 126th Street and around the corner on 8th Avenue was an oasis of a sort, symbolically. It was a bar. And sometimes the guys would go, and they would stay a little too long. And when they came back, their performance was a little
weak.
But with 15 musicians, you could kind of cover for them. And the late Walter Davis was coming from the Oasis. And he was walking very unsteadily and waving his arms. And we started to laugh because we thought Walter had been with the wine a little too long. But when he got closer, we noticed that he was crying. Walter Davis Jr., hulk of a man, at least 135 or 40 pounds. 200. Crying on a Harlem street in the day. Something had to be wrong. And he was saying something. We couldn't hear it, but when he got closer, we heard the chilling words, Clifford Brown had been killed the night before. Oh, we couldn't believe it. And nobody called him Clifford then, Brownie. Brownie dead? We couldn't believe it. You know, you heard your friend Joe died, and you see him the next day on the street. Joe, I thought you were dead. Ron Carter told me he died twice. But just at that moment, the voice from backstage, which we heard all the time when it was time to begin the next show, all on, band. We went onto the darkened stage and took our places and behind our bandstands, and this voice kept on talking, extolling how good the band was, and sometimes it was true and sometimes it wasn't, but he had to get the audience into the feeling. And while the curtain was still closed, we went into what was called a flag waver, something fast and something loud to get the attention, to garner their attention. The curtains would swing dramatically open, the lights came up to full intensity, and the bandstand rolled dramatically forward. And while all this happy-sounding stuff was going on, tears were rolling down our cheeks. There was great incertitude because we didn't know whether he was alive or dead. Was it a rumor? So we played that show. I'll tell you, we played that show. It was like no other show because we loved Clifford. But after the show was over, we found out, and you know, it was on the radio and everywhere, that Clifford was dead. And we had after we closed the Apollo Theater, we had an engagement in Hollywood. And we had a 2-week engagement there. Now, during those days, I was writing a lot of songs. Sometimes I was so prolific that I would write maybe 2 or 3 tunes in one day. And people think, oh, Benny Golson, he's a genius. But some of those tunes that were terrible, we call them dogs. My tunes, some of those tunes were so bad, they were wolves. The Maharaja and the Blues, I'm finger popping and hip shaking. I mean, they were terrible, you know. But this tune, when I started to write, it took me almost the 2 weeks to write it. Because I knew Clifford so well, I wanted every note, I wanted every interval, I wanted to write every nuance to be reminiscent of Clifford Brown. And I don't usually tell people this, but heck, what does it matter? Some of those days when I was sitting there writing, the tears were rolling down my eyes and my face because the way I felt about him. And, you know, I just about finished it at the end of the 2 weeks, and I came to work that night, that afternoon, to write, but I brought my uniform with me because I knew I wouldn't be going back to the hotel. So I was there, like you see in the movies, the bartender washing glasses, just me and the bartender. But Dizzy happened to come in early. So I said, well, since he's here, you know, let me find out what he thinks about it. Because sometimes you can create something and you think it's fantastic and it's nothing, or the antithesis of that. So I asked him, did he have a moment to hear something I was doing? So he said, yeah. So he sat down, put his trumpet case on the table, and I began to play. After about 8 bars into the tune, he opened his trumpet case. He took his trumpet out. I said, oh, wow, he doesn't even know the tune. He's going to try to play it. He really digs it. But he fooled me. He took out a flask of kerosene that he used to lubricate his valves, and that's what he started doing while I'm playing. Then he blew some, put some down the bell and blew it, and it got all over me and the piano. Oh, I was so discouraged. But I finished it. And when I finished it, he put the trumpet down and he said, that's beautiful. What is it? I said, I don't have a title yet, but I'm thinking about calling it I Remember Clifford. And I told him why I was writing it. And then he said to me, can I record that? He says, I have a recording coming up in a month with Norman Granz. You remember Norman Granz, the Philharmonic, those. Can I record it? Now, he didn't know that when I was in high school, Benjamin Franklin, I had his picture on my wall at the foot of my bed so that when I woke up every morning, I could dream that dream. Will I be good enough to play with the likes of Dizzy Gillespie one day? My hero had come down off the wall and asked me, could he record my song? I was young and foolish. Inside, I was screaming, bungee jumping, but I had to give a hip. Yeah. But in that same band was a young player, trumpet player, right here from Philadelphia, named Lee Morgan. Blue Note heard about him, and they grabbed him for his first recording. And his first recording was not coming up in the month, like Dizzy's, 2 weeks. And he wanted to record it. Lee Morgan was the first to record I Remember Clifford. Dizzy was the second. And you might remember a trumpet player named Donald Byrd. Remember the Blackbirds? He was the third one. Now, on the fourth recording, I got a surprise because I thought it was a trumpet piece. Sonny Rollins recorded it. Then after that, everybody started to record it. Then John Hendricks wrote words to it. Who was the first? Carmen McRae did it with strings. Then Dinah Washington did it, and then some other things. I'm trying to think. The Manhattan Transfer did it later. Now, I went to Japan about 7 or 8 years ago with Ron Carter. We did a thing over there. And the Japanese, they're a punctilious people. They cross every T, they dot every I. And one in the crowd there approached me and asked me the question, Mr. Golson, do you know how many recordings there are on I Remember Clifford? I never thought about it. He said, there are more than 200. I said, wow. And then I said to myself, how do they know that? But you know, I found out that any one of those Japanese who were jazz fans, you walk up to any one of them and say, who played third alto with Benny Goodman in 1939? Wham! They'll tell you just like that. About a couple of years later in New York, somebody asked me the same question. And there were over 400 recordings. And about a year ago, somebody asked me that same question again. There was over 500 recordings on it. I found out that that tune was played at weddings, at funerals, at divorces, every time, every kind of way. I Remember Clifford, yeah.
I Remember Clifford. Guys, you see how easy my job is? I don't have to talk much at all. But for someone... someone who is a, what's the word I want to use, raconteur as yourself, I understand that you had some difficulty finding the words when you first met Bobby Hurd.
She was my second wife now. See, I don't want to even tell you about the first one. You don't want to hear about disasters. When I saw her, I almost collapsed on the stage. And it was nothing about sex. It was just something about her that was different. 18 years old and a beauty. She had everything. And I said to Bobby Timmons, who is that sitting with this girl that came to see him? Who's that sitting with Ann? He said, that's the girl you just let in. Because what happened, you could only have one guest. And two were coming, one to see Bobby Timmons and her girlfriend. So I went to the door to say she was my guest. But it was kind of dim, not much light. And when I looked down and saw her, I couldn't believe it. He said, that's the girl you let in. I said, it is. I had to lean. Now, I'd heard this expression, and I'm not kidding you, about weak in the knees when you see somebody that you really dig. Man, my knees felt like rubber. I had to lean against the piano. And I was thinking all kinds of crazy stuff. And that moment, marrying her, getting the kids off to school, washing the dishes for her. I mean, it was crazy. And I said, what am I going to say to her when the break comes and I go down with Bobby, who's going to see Ann? What am I going to say? Will I do cartwheels? I said, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to embarrass myself. So we went down. I tried to be cool. I said, what's your name? She said, Bobby Hurd. And it was like a symphony, like an orchestra playing. And then I eventually said, can I have your telephone number? This is a throwback. She said, you can look in the telephone book. And I said, oh, she thinks she's cute. She thinks she's cute. Well, I had a room in a rooming house. I wasn't in a hotel. And there were no telephones in there. But about 7 o'clock in the morning, I was walking the street looking for telephone booths with the telephone book. So
you can look it up.
So I could call her. Yeah. Yeah, and when I called, she wasn't at home. I said, oh, she knew I was going to call. And her brother answered the phone. He said, no, she's at ballet school. Ballet? She's a ballet dancer? So I called. I said I wasn't going to call, but I called again. I had to call. And I got invited to her house. I met her mother. I don't know how her mother accepted me. I was 29 years old, and this girl was 18. Some of the people had to be calling me a dirty old man. But I had honorable thoughts in mind. I was divorced. I had three kids. Her mother dug me, but her grandmother didn't want anything to do with me. When we got married about a year later, everybody was there. You remember G.G. Grice, the alto player?
Yes.
He was my best man. Yeah, we got married, and her grandmother wasn't there. But she came to know me later, and she fell in love with me. So it worked out nice. Oh, boy. Now, I went to the dance school, Jones Haywood, and incidentally, Cheetah Rivera, if you remember her. She was a student there, too, at that time, to see what she was doing, you know. And from the room upstairs, they had a little square window. I could look down at the floor, and I could see them. And she was spinning, and she spun so fast, the bun that she had, you know, the ballerinas had this bun on the back, and that bun came off. Oh, and they were dancing to Schubert's Unfinished Symphony. I said, boy, isn't that something? I went to see a dance once in Boston. I said, wow, that's incredible. But after we were married, and being black, there wasn't many opportunities. She was a member of, what was that, the dance company in Washington for a while, but she was a spook to sit by the door. Oh, we have a black person, see right here? They put her out front until they got finished using it. She was finished. And she went to New York, and what was that company? Balanchine, the New York, ABT, American Ballet. And she was there for a while until they used her, and that was it. So nothing was really going to happen. And she decided, well, she would just abandon dancing, and she would help me in my career. Now, she couldn't travel with me because we soon had a daughter who's here tonight. So, oh, there she is. And she decided that she'd better raise her. So she didn't travel with me until our daughter Brielle was about, until she graduated from high school. Then she started to travel with me, and she traveled everywhere. And if the people didn't want to send me a ticket for her, I didn't take the job. We went to everywhere. Russia, Scandinavia, the Canary Islands, Hawaii, Italy, you name it. And she had to retire. And this is a sad part. And maybe I shouldn't even say it. But my wife now has Alzheimer's, and I'm losing her. Wow.
Take your time, man. It's good. We're here for you.
But I still love her. She says strange things sometimes. A couple of weeks ago, she said, "Where do you live?" I said, "Right in this bed beside you every night." Yeah, she asked me, "Where am I going?" about 10 or 20 times. And I tell her, she forgets. But she's been a wonderful wife and gave me, you know, that first marriage, I had three boys. I always wanted a girl. And she became pregnant. There were no ultrasounds then, so we didn't know. And I said, "Well, it's going to be another boy." Went to the hospital, and they came out of that room, maternity room, wherever it was. "It's a girl." And Jeff, I started to cry. And I had a newspaper in my hand. And the nurse said, "Keep that newspaper." It was the day she was, "I have that newspaper.
It's a girl, Brielle."
It's a girl. Yeah.
So one more question before we open it up to the audience members. I want to talk with you about, I saw one of your buddies last week, Jimmy Merritt.
Oh, my goodness. And we go all the way back. Yeah. 65 years at least.
He's doing well. And I was thinking about Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. Oh. And there's so many different configurations of that band.
Mm-hmm.
Some would argue that the most prolific messenger band was the one that came out of Pennsylvania with you and Bobby Timmons, Jimmy Merritt on bass, Art Blakey on drums, and Lee Morgan. Just an amazing band of musicians coming together and in playing some music with spontaneity and with soul and with feeling.
Tell us about that band. That particular album, there were albums then, was called Moanin'. So when Art Blakey always referred to that group, he would call it the Moanin' Group. And somebody asked him, out of all the 46 years that he had the Messengers together, what was his favorite group? He said, the Moanin' Group. Yeah. Incidentally, one of the tunes on that was a tune called Blues March. Mm-hmm. When I suggested that he play a march, he thought I was crazy. He said, "Nobody plays a march in jazz, except in New Orleans when you're on your way to the graveyard." I said, "Art, no, not the typical military march." I said, "Have you ever heard that College in the South, Grambling? Have you ever heard them play marches?" I said, "Their marches are funky and dirty and greasy." He never did call me Benny. "Golson, it will never work." I said, "Well, let me try, Art. It's not going to work." And finally he said yes, because he knew it wasn't going to work. And I was living in Harlem, 116th Street and 7th Avenue. I had a room with my aunt. And on the weekend, I had so much inspiration. There was one big window in my room, and I put that window up. And on the weekend, you heard automobile crashes. You heard pimps berating their ladies. You heard friendships being broke up. You heard fights. Ah, I said, now I can write. What would I write? Well, typically, let's see, a blues. I had just gotten an upright piano for $50. And the reason I got it for $50, and they delivered it, it was black, of course, but whoever had it before I had it, they were very creative. And on the left side, they started to paint it a beautiful emerald green. And they got halfway, and they got discouraged. So when I bought it, it was half green and half black. And that's the piano I wrote Blues March on. So we got to the rehearsal, and Art said, well, what do I do? I said, you remember the drummer bugle corps used to come through the neighborhood, and remember when the bugle stopped blowing the bass drum, snare, tenor drum, and the cymbals, it's just the rhythm. And I said, remember how we kids used to follow them for 20 blocks away from home, you know? Mm-hmm. I said, try to approximate something like that. He said, well, how will you and Lee know when to come in with the melody? I said, play a roll-off. He said, what's a roll-off? Well, I couldn't play the drums. I had to do it with my mouth. I said, play this. He said, oh, ghosting is not going to work. We were working in Small's Paradise up in Harlem, 7th Avenue, 135th. I said, play it. So, okay, we rehearsed it. I said, now tonight, now you see I like to talk.
I do.
And my wife always said I talk too much, but I tell some of my audiences, my wife says I talk too much, but she's not here tonight. I started talking to the audience. Ladies and gentlemen, and this was the premiere, we're going to play a tune that you've never heard the likes of in the annals of jazz. It's a march, but it's not a typical march. It's going to feature our drummer, and then I went on and on and on. Now, in Small's Paradise, there was no dancing because the place wasn't really large enough to dance. So there were little tables, just enough for sit-up and two people to sit there, but no dancing. So we started to play, and he started to play, and he played the roll-off. Lee Morgan and I start to play. Now, the people were sitting there like this. They were digging the music. And then Art added a Bobby Blue Bland backbeat. Then we saw the head started doing like that. Then he really got into it with that rhythm. And then we saw that. And after a while, these people got up and started dancing and knocking the drinks over on the floor. And he was playing. He looked over at me and said, I'll be damned. And he played Blues March with every... I don't care who came in that. He had to play Blues March.
He had to play Blues March.
And I have to tell you, nobody played it quite like him. He was something. What was the greatest experience I ever had in my career? Playing with Art Blakey.
Art Blakey.
That guy did not know how not to swing. And when I left him, because I want to do other things, I couldn't play with another drummer comfortably for 6 months. Oh, I was so uneasy. It sounded like the drummer was tuning up, preparing to play all the night. And I happened to mention it to Freddie Hubbard, and he said, you too?
Yeah.
He had the same problem when he left. It was incredible.
Benny Golson, ladies and gentlemen. Whisper Not, the autobiography of Benny Golson. And Benny will be, I guess, just out front here, and he'll be signing copies if you'd like to take him on with you. Now, if you're interested in asking Benny a question, we'll probably spend about 15, 20 minutes. Please wait for the microphone to come to you before you begin asking your question so that we can hear it.
Yes, thanks for coming in and talking with us, Benny. I want to ask you, what do you think about the jazz as it was back during the 50s and 60s, and whether the younger musicians today are continuing on that tradition? Do you think they're doing a good job with it, taking it to another level? I mean, what would you say is comparison with then and now with the music?
Music and jazz in particular has always been viable, but music, like everything else, progresses. We don't ride around in a 1930 Ford anymore. Things change, our clothing change, our styles, the foods we eat even change. I mean, at one time I used to have hair, but I changed. You see, things change. And usually, when we talk about music, it changes for the better. When things change, we won't want them to change and get worse. When we strive as musicians to practice, we don't practice to get worse, we practice to get better. And the more you do a thing, providing you have the talent, they get better. And that's what it's all about. Music's come a long way, and it might have a long way to go. This might not be the end of things. We're hearing hip-hop and lead and all kinds of things. We don't know, because we are creative people, and creativity never retires, you know? And no one person knows everything. And when we create thing that had no prior existence, it's like giving birth. And we're waiting in a symbolic, metaphoric waiting room. Is it going to be a boy or a girl? What is it going to be? And people say, you write all these popular tunes. When I wrote those tunes, I had no idea what was going to happen. My wife told me when I wrote Killer Joe, it would never make it. And after we recorded, and it did well, and she got three or four fur coats, she changed her mind. So you don't know. You find out when people start plunking their money down to buy the recordings, plunk their money down to come and hear you play. The disc jockeys are playing. They get requests. There are magazine articles about me or the music. Then you know. Because if it was the other way, I'd wake up a lot of mornings and say, oh, I think I'll write a couple of hits today. But it doesn't happen like that. We never know. You tell us.
Bert, thank you so much for so many years of wonderful music. And you're a really great storyteller. And I would like to know the inspiration for the tune Killer Joe and also Along Came Betty, because I'm part of a line of Betty's. My great-grandmother, my mother, Elizabeth, called Betty, and she named me Betty. So I need to know something about
her. I won't take up too much time, but let me tell you about Killer Joe. When I first came to New York in the mid-50s, I joined Dizzy Gillespie. And we used to play at a place called Birdland, quite often. And the way Birdland was set up, the stage was like this, but the steps coming into the club came this way, facing us. So as we were playing, we could see everybody coming in. And we used to see these guys, and they were usually black guys. They had their hair coiffed. They had on diamond rings. Their fingernails were manicured. They had on nice silk-type suits, expensive alligator shoes. Their El Dorado was being parked by the attendant upstairs. They had a lady with them, draped in fur. Sometimes they had a lady on each arm. And I found out, there were several of these kinds of guys, and I found out that none of these guys worked. Now, I was green, and I couldn't put that together. We went to Chicago. I saw the same thing. Saw the same thing in Los Angeles and Miami. We came back to Birdland. Now, the alto player next to me, he was a little older, and he had a little more experience, and he saw the look on my face. I'm looking, what's going on? These guys don't work. He leaned over to me and said, these girls work for him. I said, oh, stenographers. But 3 o'clock in the morning? You get what I'm talking about. Pimps. I said, I was writing a lot of tunes those days. I said, I got to write a tune about this. I've got to come up with a character. Now, what am I going to call? What will his name be? It has to be a common. Joe, that's a common name. Now, when I was a kid, I remember that there were guys that were writing numbers, selling bootleg liquor, And there was always somebody in the group named Killer. Killer Johnson, Killer Green. So my character, representing all the pimps in the world, was going to be Killer Joe. And I got up one morning, and I had two chords in my mind. Jan, 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 jan. Now, I couldn't play the chords and a melody that I was conceiving at the same time, so I was playing these two chords, but I was thinking in my mind what the melody was going to be. Now, my wife was in the apartment. She couldn't hear what I was thinking. All she heard from 9 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock at night was jan, jan, jan. So when I got the tune together, she was the closest one there. Oh, but let me tell you this. I kept noticing that every half hour or so, she would leave the apartment. Now, snow was on the ground, and she didn't put on any clothing. But I didn't think about it. But she was about to throw up from hearing these two chords, and she had to leave the apartment from time to time. So when I ask her, what does she think about this tune? She's waiting 12 hours for me to ask her. It'll never make it. And I told you what happened. Art Farm and I recorded it anyway. And it did well. You know, the loot started coming in, and she got these fur coats. She loves Killer Joe. I was playing with a rhythm and blues group, Bull Moose Jackson and his Buffalo Bearcats. That's who I left Philadelphia with, even though I wanted to join a jazz band. And we were playing a town called Dayton. And those days, when you were with a band and you looked out in the audience and you saw a lady that, you know, you wanted to get to know, strange things happened because you went into an altered state of consciousness. And while you were playing, maybe your eye was winking, or as you were playing, you were, meet me at the stage door, meet me. Strange stuff like that. But anyway, I got to know her. Her name was Betty. And I was still living here in Philadelphia then, and she was living in Dayton. She moved from Dayton to Philadelphia. Things were getting thick. I thought maybe I was going to marry Betty. But it turned out that Betty was a little more slick than I was. So one day, she could see I was getting tired. She disappeared. She was gone. Okay, because I had all things in mind about a marriage, but I think that was the worst close call I ever had in my life, you know, where I almost married her. Yeah, was Betty. But during the time that I knew her, I wrote a song called Along Came Betty. Now, let me finish it. I told you I met Bobby in Washington, D.C. I met Bobby and I married Bobby. And I had written this darn song, Along Came Betty. We were newly married, and I'd meet people, and they'd shake my hand, and they'd turn to Bobby and say, "And you must be Betty." And that wasn't going over too big. But I thought about changing the name to Long Came Bobby, but it's too late.
Too late. Go ahead.
Mr. Golson, what would you say out of all the compositions you did would be the ones that are the most satisfying, the most challenging to you to this date?
It's strange that you asked me that question. Many of my students ask me that question, and my answer is always the same. I haven't written it yet. No, there are things to discover, new things to do. The mind is capacious, and you have to have imagination if you're creative. If you don't have imagination as a musician, it all becomes academic. It's a moot point. You've got nothing to say. You can't think of anything.
Well, and that's why the new release is called Horizon Ahead.
That's right. And I arrived at that title because the late Hank Jones said to me, I saw him somewhere, and we were talking about the music, jazz, and he likened what we do to a horizon that is never being satisfied. And it was sort of philosophical, but then I thought about it, and what he was really saying Not arriving at the horizon and not being satisfied means you're always striving to get to the horizon. Nobody ever says, well, here we are at the horizon. There is no such thing. And there's no such thing as being totally satisfied. If you are, it's like falling overboard and the ship sails over the horizon without you and you're forgotten. No, I don't want to ever be satisfied. That's a caveat I want to avoid. I'd rather be like Avis to Hertz. They try harder. That's me.
How did you persuade Art Blakey to allow these young cats from Philly to come into the, become the jazz messengers?
I knew somebody was going to ask me that. I didn't join the messengers. I came in as a substitute. Jackie McLean had fallen ill, and he needed a sub. And I came in to play, but I knew who he was, of course, but I never played with him. I played that one night, and that experience really was like taking dope, I guess, you know, getting high. And it turned out that Jackie got better, but he decided he wanted to form his own group so he wouldn't be coming back. And now I had just about 4 or 5 days under my belt, and Art asked me, could I join as a permanent member? Oh, and I was digging what he was doing. Oh, boy. But I had to tell him no, because I just come to New York. I wanted to establish myself in New York. I was established in New York. I was established here, but I wanted to establish myself in New York, writing for singers, dancers, television commercials, and things like that. So I can't leave town. I have to be here. He says, okay. But what I didn't know about Art Blakey, he wasn't intellectual at all, but somehow he was a pocket psychologist, see, and I didn't understand that. So at the end of that first week, he said, now I know you don't want to travel, and I'm getting more days under my belt and digging what he's doing, you see. But I've got a week in Pittsburgh after this week. Now, it's not going to hurt what you want to do in your career to go to Pittsburgh with me for 1 week. No, I can go to Pittsburgh for a week. In Pittsburgh, I've got almost 2 weeks of Art Blakey under me. He's really getting to me. And at the end of the 2 weeks I've been playing with him, he said to me, didn't you go to Howard University in Washington, D.C.? I said, yes. He said, I bet you know a lot of people there, don't you? I said, oh, it's like a second home. He said, I bet the people would be glad to see you. I became a jazz messenger. And then he said, I said he wasn't making much money because I knew, because I was playing with him. And during the break one night, I said to him, Art, the way you play the drums, you should be a millionaire. His eyes widened, and he looked at me and said, what should I do? I can't believe what I said to him. I said, do everything I tell you to do. He said, what should I do? I said, get a new band. He said, tell them they're fired. I said, I can't tell them they're fired. I'm just coming in myself. But anyway, what happened? I recommended a new personnel. I said, there's a trumpet player that used to play with me in Dizzy's band. He's talented. I said, by now he's about 19. He said, well, who is he? I said, his name is Lee Morgan. He said, well, where is he from? I said, he's from Philly. Well, who have you got in mind on piano? I said, there's a fellow named Bobby Timmons, and he used to play with. I said, but he can play funky, he can play hip. He said, do you think he'll join? I said, I think. He said, what's his name? Bobby Timmons. Where's he from? I said, he's from Philly. He said, what about a bass player? I said, oh, there's a bass player that used to play with B.B. King. And when I said B.B. King, he said, oh, wait a minute. No, we can't have a bass player that used to play with B.B. King. Are you kidding me? I said, well, we used to play with Bull Moose Jackson. He can really play. Are you sure? I said, yes. He said, well, what's his name? I said, Jimmy Merritt. He said, where is he from? I said, Philly. He said, what is this Philly crap? I said, Art, you know, he's from Pittsburgh. I said, we're all from Pennsylvania. He said, Golson, you're a salesman. And that's how it happened.
What was it like coming up in Philadelphia pursuing the music, jazz?
It was like an adventure. It was a symbolic safari. We were not hunting live game. We were hunting concepts. We were hunting extrapolations, new ways of doing the old things. We were hunting new ideas. We were hunting new things to say when you play the blues. We were hunting everything possible, and we were greedy. Yes. And what helped us were those jam sessions. Now, we used to have so-called jam sessions in my living room, but they weren't really jam sessions. See, we were such novices that they were more like am sessions. We learned the J a little later. Because and John Coltrane was one of us, oh yeah. Ray Bryant was 14 years old. Now, nobody knows about Ray Bryant. Ray Bryant went to Central High here, that academics high school, and he was one of the top students. Ray could have been a surgeon, an astronaut, a lawyer. He could have been anything, but he chose music. And at 14 years old, he was amazing. Any tune that he knew, and this is difficult, any tune he knew, he could play in any key. Extraordinary. Well, where am I? My wife says I talk too much. Maybe I do. Where was I?
Well, we are actually... We're going to wrap this up at this point.
We're going to wrap it up. Yes. Okay.
Yes, because... and see if I can get... I don't want to wear your hands out because you might have to sign your book a couple of times.
Yeah, I've been practicing. I've got muscles here.
Oh, well, good. Good. You're in good shape. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming out tonight. The book is Whisper Not, the autobiography of Benny Golson. And please, take it home with you. Put it in your collection. It's some wonderful anecdotal stories. It's about life and some of the ups and downs that life provides us as an everyday occurrence. And Benny has had some wonderful opportunities. You know, I wish everyone could have the opportunity to just meet some of the people that you've come in contact with over the years.
It was exciting.
Oh, man. Traveled the world, and it was because he put his life into the music. And so thank you very much for coming out. We appreciate it. Benny Golson.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.